Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Great to have our turf expert, Doug Soldat, with us. He's professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison, specializes in turf grass and urban soils and nutrient management. He looks at water resources and soil testing and landscape irrigation. So there's lots we can talk about with Doug. And I hope you'll join in. What lawn care questions do you have? Maybe you need some help making your lawn more eco-friendly. Love to hear from you. Maybe you've had disease or weed problems in the past. Lots to discuss. And you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Doug Soldat, good to have you back with us.
Great to be here, Larry. Always a pleasure.
Sometimes, something we get asked a lot is about No Mow May.
Yeah.
Comes up every year about
this
time.
Yeah.
For those, you maybe explain the concept.
Sure, yeah. No Mow May is, a movement that has some roots in Wisconsin, up in Appleton, community in Appleton. Began encouraging people to not mow their lawns in May. And the idea behind that is that there's more than just grass in most lawns, and some of those other plants will bloom. And, of course, the flowers provide a source of nectar to pollinators in the early spring when there's generally not a lot of other sources around. So I think that concept connected with people as a way that they, you know, nature right outside their house, that they could have a positive influence. So we've been doing work around that concept of, you know, what happens if you stop mowing your lawn for an entire month? Do you need to do that? Are there other ways to enhance the pollinator community? So that's the idea behind it.
So what's your research found on it?
Yeah, it's interesting, and we still have all kinds of different plots out there that are related. One of the newest ones that we seeded last fall has, and we see this on the shelves now. You see not just grass seed, but other plants, clovers and yarrow and heal all that are incorporated into these lawn seeds, so that the community can be more than just grass. So we're evaluating those: which ones work, which ones look the best. When do the flowers come out? So there's still tons to learn about how to incorporate other plants on purpose into your lawn. And at the OJ North Center out near Verona, Wisconsin, we have a whole bunch of stuff going on.
Yeah. The grass can get pretty long by the end of May.
Yeah.
I tried it, a couple weeks in, through 2.5 weeks in, it was just...
Right. And I think that's probably my assessment, too, is that... You know, not mowing for the entire month of May is probably there's probably better ways to do it. So the grass actually, when you allow it to grow too much and then you try to cut it down, it can be stressful for the grass. It can be difficult in the mower. It can be frustrating. It can result in some pretty undesirable looking conditions. So the things that we're evaluating, have been evaluating, is just mowing less frequently, mowing higher. Those things will allow more blooms to occur in the lawn and maybe accomplish a couple goals at once, with providing more diversity in the lawn, but also making it so your lawn is manageable in June, July, and August.
Yeah, good points. Dave in Sussex has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. How do you get rid of fairy ring in your lawn and prevent it from spreading?
What are fairy rings?
Yeah.
Start with that, Doug.
So fairy ring is it's a fungus, probably several species, that break down organic matter in the soil. And when they do that, and that's their job, when they break down organic matter, they release nitrogen. And nitrogen makes the grass green and grow a little more. So I think what Dave is probably seeing are these green rings in his lawn that show up. And unfortunately, there's really nothing you can do to eliminate it. It's a natural process. It's related to how much organic matter is in your soil. You can't change that. You really wouldn't want to change it. But it does indicate that your grass might be nitrogen deficient because you're seeing where the nitrogen is, you're seeing a different response. So proper fertility, I'd suggest that. So fertilizing 2-3 times a year will minimize the extreme difference between the rings. And other than that, just understand that it's a natural thing. It's not killing the grass. It's just a component of what's going on underground.
Dave, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. I had a weird situation. It was last summer. I had a mushroom come up in the middle of the lawn. It was a large one. I took some photos of it, and I've got to find somebody who can identify it. I've never seen a mushroom like it. And I couldn't figure, just one, and it was a pretty good size. And then I realized it was on the spot where 10 years earlier, it had been 10 years, and so there may not be any relationship at all, but I had a dead tree in the back lawn, dying tree, and I took it out before it fell on the house. And I wondered if it had come up from that area.
Yep, absolutely. So fairy rings kind of go in a circle, but you will see other mushrooms pop up, especially where there were old tree roots, because the fungus is down there eating those, decaying that wood. And then when the conditions are right, and this is true with fairy rings, and fairy rings, you can see mushrooms pop up around the ring. They say, okay, it's time to spread our spores. So it comes up, you get that fruiting body, the spores disperse, and look for other tree roots, decaying tree roots to work on. Yeah.
I've got to get a mushroom expert on and show them
yeah.
the photo, because it was unlike anything I've ever seen before. Well, you can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Bert emailed, aren't some communities switching to the idea of slow-mo May? What's that about?
Yeah, slow-mo May, mow high in May. I mean, so variations on the theme that, like I mentioned earlier, are trying to accomplish both of the tasks. So if you don't mow for the entire month of May, you can run into some trouble. So these sort of hybrid alternate methods are designed to kind of get the best of both worlds. So slow-mo May would just be mow less frequently. Mow high, think about raising the deck on your mower higher. And that's a good thing no matter what. It's good for the grass. You get deeper roots, better access to water and nutrients. So again, there's a fact sheet that the University of Wisconsin Extension has on, it's called What's the Deal with No-Mow May? And it talks about all of these things in more detail. So you can Google that and check out that publication for more information.
Had another caller who couldn't stay with us, but mentioned he just recently received his soil test report. It stated that the potassium level was 59.
Okay.
And what does he look for when, does he need potassium? What does he look for when purchasing potassium?
Yeah, that's a good one. So
what's a 59?
59 parts per million. So soil testing can be a little confusing, a little jargony. Hopefully the soil test report would have alongside that 59, a bar that tells you, you know, is it low, medium, or high? And 59, I'm going to guess that's right on the border between low and medium. So the report might recommend a potassium fertilizer, which is probably the reason for the caller's question. So the potassium is the third number on a bag of fertilizer. So they'll have, you know, three numbers, 34, zero is the middle, is usually zero because we want to keep phosphorus. That's the middle number, low to keep our water clean.
And then we already have enough phosphorus.
Most soils have enough. So again, a great reason to soil test is if your soil is short on potassium, it is a good idea to apply it. But you don't want to apply it unless you don't need it. And then the last number on the bag is potassium. So you're looking for a higher last number, and there's not an exact number that you need to find, but you don't want it to be zero or in the single digit. So a double digit last number would be a good fertilizer to apply if you have a relatively low amount of potassium in your soil.
makes good sense. Well, there's been a lot of interest in lawn alternatives. What kind of research are you doing at the lab on replacements for sort of the typical grass?
Yeah. So I'll first start off by saying grass is a great option for Wisconsin. It grows. You can plant Kentucky bluegrass and fine fescue and do very little maintenance on it, and it's going to survive. It's going to have good ground cover. It's going to prevent erosion. So there's nothing inherently wrong with grass itself. I think some of the concerns people have is about the management of the grass. However, you can, if you don't like to add fertilizers, clover, white clover, is a special plant that takes nitrogen from the air. We're breathing, 79-80% nitrogen right now, but it's unavailable as a fertilizer. But clover and other plants that are legumes can take that nitrogen and make it available, and they also share it. So a lot of our kind of alternative lawns are mixtures of Kentucky bluegrass and fine fescue and white clover, which pair together really well. They provide a nice dense turf that you can play around on, have parties, enjoy the look of it, but will require little to no nitrogen. When you have sufficient nitrogen, you usually don't get weeds coming in, and just a healthier lawn. So again, white clover is probably the top plant, but we're looking at other types of clovers and other non-grass plants that we can include with the grass to meet all of our kind of our goals for a lawn.
And white clover used to be, I think we've talked about this, they used to put it in all the time in seeds back in the, 50s, 60s?
Yeah, 90s? I think they took it out around the 50s. So
around the 50s?
But sure, in the early 50s and the 40s, if you bought a bag of grass seed, it was, in the north, it was Kentucky bluegrass and white clover. And here we are, and we're finding, guess what? Guess what a really nice mix is Kentucky bluegrass and white clover. I'll add to that the fine fescues, specifically Chewing's fine fescue and hard fescue. They're just slight variations within the fine fescue family, are very good grasses to include with Kentucky bluegrass and white clover for these sort of very low input, sustainable lawns in Wisconsin.
Dale in Nina has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dale.
It's Bill. And my Kentucky bluegrass yard that's 25 years old is invaded with quack grass. How do I fight that?
Oof. Quack grass is one of the most difficult ones to fight, unfortunately. And the reason for that is that it has these really, really deep rhizomes. A rhizome is an underground stem, and they can get as thick as a pencil, and they can go down like 18 inches. And even if you kill all the top material, new quack grass will resprout from those rhizomes, which are so deep. So I'm going to first start off with the conventional recommendation for getting rid of it, and then we'll talk, which you're not going to like, and then we're going to talk about some other alternatives. So a non-selective herbicide like Roundup is one, and there's other versions of that, but something that will be translocated down to the roots and kill most of the plant. That's also going to kill your 25-year-old Kentucky bluegrass lawn. It's going to kill all the plants that you apply it to. Then what's going to happen is the quack grass will actually survive and come back up, and at which point we'd recommend another application of Roundup, which will kill everything, and then a third time. So again, it's so persistent because of those thick rhizomes. Most people don't like to do that. And so quack grass thrives in sort of lower maintenance situations where you're mowing less frequently or mowing higher, or you're not providing a lot of nitrogen or fertilizer. And so those are three things that you could change. You could start mowing your lawn a little bit lower. So again, that's kind of counter to all the evidence, all the usual recommendations I give, but it's specific to quack grass control. So mow it a little bit lower. I'm talking about 2 inches. And then adds fertilizer 3 times a year, Memorial Day, 4th of July, Labor Day are good timings for that. And over time, what you should see is that the Kentucky bluegrass will slowly outcompete the quack grass. It'll take years and years, and you won't ever fully eradicate it. The next alternative method is a chemical called mesotrione, sometimes sold as Tenacity, that will turn the quack grass white. It won't completely kill it, but if you make repeated applications of mesotrione according to the label directions, you can slowly push back the concentrations of quack grass or the amount of quack grass. But it is it's a difficult one to control, unfortunately.
Yeah. There you go, Dale. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Doug Soldat, our guest today, professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison. We're talking lawns with him today. And you can join in at 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Taking a look at your lawn today on the show with our guest, Doug Soldat, professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison. He actually chairs the department, as a matter of fact. Great to have him with us, a lawn expert, and been with us over many a year now, and it's always great to have him back. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Don in Iron River has something. Let's go there. Hi, Don.
Hello. Say, when I was about 8 years old, my dad made me cut the lawn, and that's my worst favorite task in the world.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, it's probably a lot of people don't like to mow their lawn, but it does. Thanks for calling, Don, because it does bring up the whole question of lawnmowers. One thing you could do, Don, I think if you don't like to do it yourself, Doug?
Yeah. I mean, so the good news is there's actually a solution for people like you that don't like to mow lawn. And it's funny because I think, you know, some people almost view it as a therapy thing. Sometimes I see people with these huge lawns that you probably don't need that much grass to mow, and you talk to them about it and say, I just like the 2 hours out of my riding mower, I can zone out and not think about work. So, but then on the other side, like, oh man, why do I have to do this? I'd rather do other things. So robot mowers are a good solution, Don. I think we've seen a lot of technological improvements. We've seen the prices come down on these things. Some of them don't even need boundary wires. So the older ones that we've been looking at for the last 5 or so years, you have to put down a wire so the mower knows when to stop and turn around. The newer ones have GPS capabilities that don't even require that. So check out the options for robotic autonomous mowers. If they fit your budget, might be a real, and they just continually mow. Then when it's low on battery, it goes back and it charges itself. So of course there's going to be bumps in the road. It's going to get stuck in spots. But if you don't like to mow, a robotic mower, I think, is a really, really cool solution for you.
And just other mowers I have, and I'm not ego, EGO does not pay me to say anything, but I have an EGO lawnmower and I love it.
Yeah.
It's got some, if you can, I have a couple of batteries.
Yep.
And I can mow a long time on a battery. It can be self-propelled. I usually just push it, but because I think it probably burns more battery up if you use the self-propelled. But occasionally I'll click it on for a minute if I'm in a tough situation. It really does a nice job. And what I really like about it is you can be pretty precise on the height, the cutting height.
Yeah.
With it as well. And it's easy to adjust the cutting height.
Right. Right.
So.
And they're quieter, the electric mowers.
Oh, yeah. 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 I had a lawnmower with that was on a cord, electric on a cord. And after running over the cord.
Yeah.
three times. I think it was the third time was the the cord was no longer usable. I ditched the whole works and went with that.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of change in the mower space for consumers, and we're even seeing it. Golf courses are switching to these autonomous mowers really rapidly. I visited a golf course in Norway that had, I forget the total, like 70 autonomous mowers that were always going around.
Oh my goodness.
And there's like there's a robotic dog. Have you seen, maybe you've seen these on social media that like look like a little, you know, robot dog, and you can outfit like soil moisture sensors on these things. So we've seen golf courses send out this dog. Is what the golfers think it's crazy, kind of cool, and it's sending useful information back to the golf course superintendent on, you know, soil moisture and soil temperature. It's just a wild time to be in lawn maintenance, golf course maintenance.
Yeah, well, we may find time to talk some more about that, but we thank Don, and now let's go to Gary in Janesville. Hi, Gary.
Hello. I am being invaded by Creeping Charlie from every direction, it seems like. What's my solution?
Yep, another one. Quackgrass is one of the toughest. Creeping Charlie is, or ground ivy is another name for it, is slightly easier to control, but it loves shade. So my guess is it's in a shaded environment. It doesn't have to be, but it's more aggressive in shaded environments because grass really doesn't like shade. So there's less competition for the ground ivy to the Creeping Charlie to come in. So what can you do for it? The best conventional solution is an herbicide called triclopyr, applied around the time of the first frost. The second best timing for an herbicide called triclopyr is when it is blooming, which should be probably in the next several weeks. It has these little purple flowers on it. Because it is such an aggressive, fast-growing weed, those solutions are unlikely to be the final word. It'll push it back, but repeat applications are likely necessary. Alternative way, pulling it, but again, you always constantly be pulling it. And then living with it is another thing that after long battles with things, people learn to try to appreciate the smell that you get or the purple flowers and just kind of waving the white flag on it. But yeah, that's what I would recommend. Triclopyr is a conventional option. There's also, you can try alternative herbicides that contain iron, H-E-D-T-A. Basically an organic product, very low toxicity to the environment or humans or pets or anything. Timings would be the same on that, but you're going to have to apply it, repeat two or three applications. But in the spring when it's flowering and in the fall around the first frost are good times for the iron HEDTA product.
Many years ago, I had a fairly small lawn, but there was a lot of Creeping Charlie in it. I was mad about it, and so I eliminated the entire lawn, had somebody come over and put in a new lawn for me. And within a year, I had Creeping Charlie back because the neighbors had some and it just comes over.
Yeah.
That's the problem, Gary, from Janesville.
Yeah. Yeah. And then to keep it out. So, you know, at our research farm, we study this all the time. And if I kill it with triclopyr, I can get most of it out. And then if I don't do anything else and I just wait for 2 years, it'll be exactly back, right?
Yeah.
So, but if I wanted to keep it out, what I would do is I'd make the lawn denser by adding nitrogen fertilizer because, again, that will slow the advance. Now, you can't do that in the shade. In the shade, adding nitrogen fertilizer will probably just make your grass worse. And that's why the shade is the very difficult place. But if you do, Gary, I'm not sure if you have full sun or not, but if it is full sun, I'd say fertilize properly. So three applications per year, Memorial Day, 4th of July, Memorial Day as your timings. And that will help keep the Creeping Charlie out.
Thanks again for calling, Gary. Rose in Toma, we'll go to you now. Hi, Rose.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm having trouble with sheep sorrel about the last 3 years, and it's just like impossible since it seeds from the top and crawls from the bottom. And I'm wondering what I should do for that.
And it is in your lawn, Rose.
Yes.
How the heck did it get in
there? Well, what used to be a lawn.
You now have a sheep sorrel lawn, or at least a lot of sheep sorrel in the lawn.
Yeah, that's one I don't have a ton of experience with. It's a perennial. With perennial weeds, there's some reason that it's doing better in that spot than the lawn is. And so, you know, I'd recommend an application of a conventional herbicide in the fall. So around that timing of first frost is usually most effective. And then focusing on proper lawn maintenance to get that lawn healthy. And there's a lack of density, interseeding or overseeding, a better grass variety might be a way to keep the lawn density up. We've talked several times already on the show about the proper fertilizer, three applications, spring, summer, fall, to keep the density up. But there's some reason that sorrel has come in. And sorrels generally like kind of lower fertility, like poor soils, acid soils. So do a soil test, see what the soil pH is. You might have to add some lime to raise the pH if the pH is too low for the grass. That's how I'd tackle a sorrel problem.
Yeah, Rose is in Toma, so a soil test would be really good for
her.
Yeah,
right.
Varies a bit up there.
Right.
Good luck, Rose. Thank you for calling. Kathy in Stillwater, Minnesota, will go to you. Hi, Kathy.
Hello. I have, unfortunately, friends who have jumping worms in their lawn. Another friend has it in the garden, and they think probably mulch is the problem. However, I'm afraid to buy now anything to add to my yard or my garden. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, jumping worm is a relatively new problem. And at first, we thought, they don't damage the lawn, but we've certainly learned in the last few years that they do directly damage lawns. Unfortunately, there are no chemical control strategies for them. There's really no good cultural practices to keep them out. I think, Larry, you've probably had PJ Leash on this program talking about it. I don't know if you have any thoughts on jumping worms that you can share.
No, there really is no cure for it. I mean, you can get rid of them, a lot of them, but they are very prolific breeders. And so the best of advice is always make sure when you get plants, you know, where are those plants from? Are they, I don't know if they certify jumping worm free, but it's the most important thing is to not bring them in.
Yeah. And it sounds like that's already happened.
Yeah, they can come in the mulch. So I would, you know, if I'm buying mulches, I'm buying from reputable outfits for sure that can guarantee that there are no jumping worms in them, unfortunately.
Yeah, one of the hopes, I remember, 10, 15 years ago, Japanese beetle damage was everywhere in Dane County area, and now we don't hear too much about it because the native animals will kind of figure out, here's something tasty to eat. And so that's one of my hopes with jumping worms in these landscape areas is that that predators recognize them as a good food source and their damage drops off.
And we've had people call and say, the robins or whatever birds are chomping them down really well. So that may happen. Kathy, I wish we had more for you. Thank you for calling. Nick in Green Bay. Your turn, Nick. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My answer to my question, when I tell my wife to call the landlord, she doesn't think it's very humorous. So we just bought a house, and they had to shore up the walls, and so they tore up the grass and I was wondering what the best way of getting the grass to grow. And the problem I got is I got a 100-foot pine tree in the front of the house, and I've got two dogs in the back of the house. So I'm worried that if I plant grass in the back of the house, the dogs will destroy it. And I'm not sure with how acidy the soil is going to be with that pine tree being right there.
Yeah, common problems. I'm going to talk you through kind of how I would approach it. The pine tree can be acidic soil, but you might want to do a soil test to be sure. But in most cases, or in some cases, the reason you don't see a lot of grass growing under pine trees is because of the shade and the water competition. Those roots will suck up a lot of water, and new grass seedlings need adequate water, and the tree can pull that back. So I like to mulch around trees, especially the conifers, landscape around them, because it's very, very difficult to get a good stand of grass. If you're going to try to get something to grow underneath a pine tree, I would go with Chewings Fine Fescue. You can find it online exclusively, or you can buy, a lot of garden centers will have mixtures of grasses that have Chewings Fine Fescue in it. So you flip over the bag, you read the fine print. So you're looking for Chewings Fine Fescue. It's your best option for a situation like that. Now with the dogs, I'd put up a snow fence. You have to keep the dog traffic off of it for like the first 6 weeks. Once the ground cover is 80%, the dogs aren't going to damage it anymore, but you have to find a way to keep the dogs off of it during that time. So that might be impossible in your situation, but if it is possible, that's how I'd deal with that. And again, I think the best general type of grass is one that's going to contain Kentucky bluegrass and fine fescue for most situations.
Nick, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Jay in Two Rivers. Hi, Jay.
Good morning, gentlemen, and good Friday to you both.
Thank you.
To you as well.
We've restricted our dogs to our backyard for the last 40 years, so every spring I have to reseed a little bit. And the backyard is not full sun, but I try to educate myself by listening to this program, and the seed I'm using is a combination of Chewings Fescue, Hard Fescue, Creeping Fescue, and some perennial rye. But most of the grass available now, or grass seed, especially for shade, is coated with a moisture-retaining substance that actually 50% of the weight. And I'm wondering if there are any disadvantages that if we have a stretch of long, wet weather like we did last June, I think, that might actually start to rot the grass seed. And is this too early to start seeding? Because here in Two Rivers, it doesn't get over 50 for a while yet.
Yeah,
a lot of good stuff there. So first off, I really like your grass seed choices. For repairing damaged areas, perennial ryegrass and the fine fescues are going to germinate quickly. The ryegrass is going to slowly get phased out over the next couple years, which is fine. And then the fine fescue will survive. So I give that an A+. The seed coating, probably not necessary. We see it a lot. I think there's been seed shortages. And so one way that the seed companies are trying to get seed out to everyone is by putting fillers in and basically selling you less seed in the bag. The coating, I don't think it's going to cause you any problems. And like you said, with too much moisture retention and the seed rotting, I think that's probably going to happen no matter what, if it's really wet for a prolonged period of time. But the research has shown that they provide very little benefit, unfortunately. So if you can find an uncoated seed, you're going to get more seed for your money. It's probably not going to hurt anything if that's all you can find. But like you said, it's really common to see it.
Jay, thank you for calling. And Rob in La Crosse. Hi.
Good morning. I was calling in reference to the guy that was calling about the Creeping Charlie.
Yeah.
And I've had good luck with a product called 4-Speed XT. And in the La Crosse area, there's only one store that actually carries that, which is the Ace Hardware over in West Salem. The one in La Crosse doesn't carry it. But the thing I like about it is that you put it down, as long as you don't over-strength it, the Creeping Charlie just kind of disappears. It doesn't turn it all brown so that it looks bad. It just makes it disappear. So I would have that offer. I don't know if it would affect the bluegrass because I just have a regular lawn.
Do you have? Do you know what's in that? It's called 4-Speed. Did you say?
It's called 4-Speed XT, and you can Google it. But go ahead.
Yeah. It's so 4-Speed is. I'm looking at the label right now. It contains triclopyr, which is why you see such good effects. So it has four. In the name comes from the four active ingredients, and one of those four is triclopyr, which is our conventional recommendation. So 4-Speed would be a good choice for that. There are other there's so many different we call these kind of three-way or four-way herbicides that contain multiple active ingredients. You can buy a product with just triclopyr that is likely to give you good success. This one has other active ingredients including triclopyr, which is why you're seeing that success. But yeah, thanks for that.
Yeah, thanks, Rob, appreciate the call. Our guest today, Doug Soldat, talking lawns with him. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk. We're taking a look at lawns right now on the show. On the last half hour of the show, we'll talk with the author of a new book on edible and medicinal herbs. So looking forward to that. And a quick note that next week we'll talk about foraging with Sam Thayer and look at insects you'll find in your garden, the good ones and the bad ones for you. So that's all coming up. Right now, though, lawns. And Perry in Oconto has a question for our guest, Doug Soldat. Hi, Perry.
Hello. And before I ask my two questions, just want to encourage everybody to get out and contact their Congress people to let them know we want to keep public broadcasting funded. Now I'll get to my questions.
Thank you.
Very important to do. High traffic areas, is there any kind of ground cover? It could be grass or even something else that you walk through that would hold up to very heavy traffic, and also some kind of ground cover plants for a area that deals with erosion.
Yeah, great.
Just one question for you, though, Perry. When you talk heavy traffic, is this like kids playing soccer, or is it one specific area?
It's one specific area by the gate where the dog goes through.
Okay.
Yeah, well, sometimes, so there can be levels of traffic where nothing is going to work, but I'm going to tell you the best solution. So this may fail, but the best thing you can do is tall fescue. I actually kind of, sometimes I call it the dog park grass because it's a little thicker, which gives it a little bit more wear tolerance, has deeper roots. You could also throw in a little bit of clover. So one of the solutions that we give to sports fields that get high traffic and the grass wears out is more nitrogen. So that traffic is you're tearing off leaves. You need to grow more grass, and so a little bit more nitrogen helps. You can do that by sprinkling a little bit out of the bag with your hand occasionally, but you can also add a clover to that area. Clover doesn't love traffic, but it will provide nitrogen to the tall fescue that you plant there that will convey a little bit more traffic tolerance than the grass you probably have.
That makes good sense. Say, Tim emailed to say that Roundup, you mentioned Roundup, I think, has 14 different herbicides. Some have no glyphosate at all in them. Many have some very toxic. Well, so it's important to say glyphosate instead of Roundup.
Yeah, that's a good point. Glyphosate is originally called Roundup, and Roundup has decided to call everything in their portfolio Roundup for lawns. Glyphosate is the non-selective herbicide that comes in many forms that will be useful in that, in the quack grass situation that I discussed.
Yeah. And Janine in Fond du Lac emailed to ask about adding creeping thyme to a lawn. Would that work?
Yeah, creeping thyme is one that we're investigating and looking at, and you can find it in seed mixes. And so, you know, there's only a handful of plants that really can survive that mowing that lawns receive and the traffic, and creeping thyme is definitely one of them. We've only been studying it for a year or two at the O.J. North Center, so I don't have a ton of insight into it, but it's absolutely one of those alternative grass plants.
Kathy in Oconomowoc, we'll go to you. Hi, Kathy.
Well, hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I have a very lumpy lawn, and when I'm mowing my grass with my walk-behind lawnmower, I mean, it's so lumpy that I could sprain my ankle just walking on it. So is there any way I can correct a lumpy lawn without having to start over from scratch and rototilling it under and starting over again?
Yeah, thanks for that. It's a common issue. There's not a lot of very easy solutions to it. And so, like you said, one of them would be just like, you know, totally start over. But we'll throw that out the window, and we can say there's two other methods that I'll throw at you here. One would be getting a lawn roller. And so that is something we don't love to recommend, because you're compacting, you're kind of squishing down the high spots into the low spots, which can make it more difficult for the roots to grow, but that will smooth things out, especially for the kind of the smaller topography changes. The other thing you could try, depending on how big the dips are, is top dressing. So you can get 5-gallon buckets of soil and then kind of rake them in on the low spots to try to even out the high spots. That's something I'm actually doing on my lawn, and I've been doing it slowly over the last 3 years to a couple low spots. So you don't want to smother it. You want to still see some grass after you rake in some topsoil. And then once you can't see the topsoil anymore, do it again. And eventually those low spots will raise up to the level that you want. But lawn roller, you fill it with water, you go back and forth many, many times until you are satisfied with the smoothness. That's probably one of your best options.
Kathy, there you go. Thanks so much. Doug, who's on the road in Wisconsin, we'll go to you. Hi, Doug.
Well, a good Friday to you both. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have moss growing in my yard. I am north of Wisconsin Dells in Sand Country, not too far from the Wisconsin River, and the moss is spreading beautifully, and it's a no-mow. It's like a carpet, but how can I accelerate the growth of the moss, because it, where it comes in and takes over, it actually takes over the grass and knocks it down. Last year, I only had to mow 3 times.
Yeah, that's great. I wasn't sure where you're going with it, and I like this angle too. So moss can form; it survives a lot of different situations, and what we say about moss is it's an indication that the grass doesn't like to grow there. So it can be shady sites, it can be very dry sites on your sandy soils. In terms of speeding it up, though, I don't think there's much you can do other than just wait and time, and so just keep at it and kind of enjoy the process, but the moss will continue to invade where the grass is doing weak, and yeah, you can reap the benefits of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Doug, thank you. Jane in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I'm thinking of adding Dutch white clover to my lawn as I fill in bare spots, and I'm wondering, does that spread from the root? And or do I have to let it get tall enough so that it flowers and spreads from seed?
Yeah, no, you don't need to let it spread by seed. It'll spread by stolon. So these are above ground creeping stems. But what I would actually recommend, if you want to put white clover into your lawn, I would put it everywhere. And so what I would do is rent one of these. Sometimes they're called the thatch rake. Or a power rake, and it's a relatively easy piece of equipment. It looks like a lawnmower, but it spins vertical tines that will create maybe 1-inch apart slits in your lawn. And then I would just spread the clover seed everywhere, because I think with your strategy of like doing the patchy, you're going to see patches of white clover. It's going to look lumpy and sort of non-uniform. But if you do it the way that I recommended, you're going to get the white clover everywhere, and it'll look less lumpy and patchy, because white clover will grow like crazy in midsummer. It might form a big mound, and then your grass will just be kind of sitting there, and it'll look weird. So a power rake, a thatch rake, an overseeder, and put the white clover everywhere, and I think that's the best approach.
Jane, there you go. Thank you. And Linda in Appleton. Hi, Linda.
Hey, good morning, guys. Hey, thank you for the program. I have buckthorn in my yard, in my grass. I've had it identified. Is there some place where I can send some of these samples? You know, I went out this morning and it's starting to come up. And, you know, it's already maybe, well, some of it is like an inch above the ground already. To double check that it is that I keep mowing it, so, you know, it never gets too tall. But is there anything I can spray on it and not kill the grass?
We've actually seen this. We did an inventory of plants in a site at our research station, and we found buckthorn, which surprised me. So just keep mowing it. That's the story, is that there are very few plants on earth that can survive sustained mowing. Buckthorn is not one of them. It can survive it a little bit, but why you're seeing it now is the birds eat the seeds, and then their bird droppings it'll start to grow, and it can probably tolerate a little bit of mowing, but eventually, even if you see a whole bunch of it now, it's going to be gone eventually. So just keep the mowing up. You could add, if you're not fertilizing, fertilize once or twice will increase the density and make it less likely that those buckthorn seeds get take a foothold, but I don't recommend using any herbicide or any chemical treatment, because the mower will take care of it eventually. It'll just take a bit of time.
There you go, Linda. Thank you for calling. Rick emailed to ask if he can transplant Creeping Charlie from Wisconsin to Florida, or is there an equivalent in Florida? He has several large live oaks that shade an area where no grass will grow.
Oh gosh, I don't know. I wouldn't recommend it. What I would do is, in Florida, I would reach out to a local expert on native landscaping and find a plant that fits that situation. But ground ivy or creeping Charlie is probably not the answer for that.
I'm sure the state of Florida must have an extension service.
Yeah, University of Florida has a wonderful extension service and landscape horticulture, and that would be a wonderful starting point.
Yeah, I think so. Mary wonders, and this is, we've kind of covered it, but what's the best grass seed for shade?
Best grass seed for shade, hands down, is Chewings Fine Fescue. But most of all of the grasses in the fine fescue family, hard fescue, creeping red fescue, slender red fescue, sheep's fescue, those will all be good in the shade. But Chewings Fine Fescue is the best one for shade in Wisconsin. Dry shade.
Dry shade.
Give me one more minute here. I'll say Poa Supina or Supina bluegrass is the best grass for wet shade. And that's expensive. You can find it online. Supina, Supina bluegrass is your best option for wet shade.
Our guest today, Doug Soldat, professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison, and we're talking with him about your lawn, and he will be with us for another half hour on the show, so we're looking forward to having him stick around for another half hour, and you'll be able to join in with your emails at talk@wpr.org or phone 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. We're talking lawns on Garden Talk right now. Larry Mealer here with our guest, Doug Soldat, professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison. And, of course, Doug specializes in turf grass and urban soils and water and soil testing and landscape irrigation. So great to have him with us to answer your lawn questions. And Jeff, who's near Sun Prairie, has a question. So let's go there. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call, and I appreciate tuning in. I'm by actually Pleasant Prairie.
Oh, Pleasant Prairie.
Right. I'm listening to WGTD 91.1.
Good for you. Thank you.
So, yeah, it's a blessing to hear all the new information, and I'm planning on aerating my lawn, and that's where my question is. I'd like to superseed from that and really look at looking for a mixture, a seed mixture that would be more hardy for heat and sun.
Okay.
With the climate change, I'm noticing.
Sure, sure. So the most heat and probably drought tolerant grass that we have is also a good. It does well in sort of low maintenance situations called tall fescue. This grass, basically, you couldn't find it before the 1990s, and after the drought in I think 86 or 88, its grass breeders started to move it up, and so now it used to be really wide bladed light green, and now it looks more like kind of traditional grasses, but it has deep roots, very heat tolerant. If you go down to St. Louis or New Jersey, you find a lot of tall fescue. Its problem, though, it doesn't really like ice cover. It will die under ice. So if you have ice cover occasionally, it's not a good choice. But tall fescue is your best heat, drought-tolerant grass for Wisconsin.
And the aerating is good?
Yeah, aerating is a good time to seed. I do have some concerns. I think a better way to do it is get an overseeder, which will actually cut slits in the ground, and you can do that in a couple different directions to get more even take of your tall fescue. You know, the problem with aeration is only a hole every 2 inches, and you tend not to get really good coverage with it that way. So
should be able to rent those, shouldn't you?
Yeah, you can rent an overseeder or a thatch rake to kind of create the slits in your soil yourself, and then spread the seed on top of those slits. So those are probably two better options than aerating and reseeding. Aerating's good for kind of breaking up some compaction, but it's not the best option for seeding.
Jeff, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Margaret in Stoughton, it's your turn. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. Love your show, Larry. What do you think about using chamomile as a substitute for grass?
I don't have a ton of experience with chamomile in lawns. One of the things that we're learning, though, is like it's more, you know, think about mixing chamomile in with grass plants. So a lawn is like a collection of plants, and chamomile might be a good component of that with creeping thyme and heal all and yarrow and white clover and fine fescue and Kentucky bluegrass. So generally, if you plant just a single, you know, species, you're setting yourself up for some trouble down the road. But if you think about it as more of a component or a community of plants, chamomile may be an option for you.
And we'll probably talk about chamomile in the last segment of the show. It may come up as we talk about herbs in every season with our next guest, Margaret. Thomas in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Thomas.
Hey, good afternoon. About 4 years ago, I planted no-mow grass seed on my city lot. I got the seed from Prairie Nursery. And I'm having problems with crabgrass. I think it's crabgrass, and I don't know how to deal with that.
Good, yeah. So, you know, proper plant ID is always an important component. There's resources you can do that online. Crabgrass is a warm season grass. It germinates when the soil temperatures are sort of in the 60s. And it's an annual, so as soon as we get a frost, it usually dies. The good news with crabgrass, though, is with proper herbicide applications, it's very easy to prevent. And that timing is right about now. So pre-emergent herbicide, and there's a handful of them, dithiopyr, prodiamine, pendimethalin are the conventional ones. And then corn gluten meal is an organic alternative. If all of those are applied right about now, you're going to see dramatic or even complete control or prevention of crabgrass for the growing season. So get out there, look for a product that fits your needs, make that follow the label directions, make the application, and you shouldn't see crabgrass this summer.
And, well, it's in Green Bay, but even so...
Yeah, I'd say like southern Wisconsin, the timing is right about now. So in Green Bay, you could be looking at the next week or so. The forsythia are a good indicator. So forsythia, these landscape plants that have these bright yellow flowers that are some of the first to bloom. And when those are in full bloom, that tells you the timing is probably about right.
Thomas, good luck. Thank you for calling. And you could join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. Mark in Rushford, Minnesota, what's on your mind?
Hello, gentlemen. I have questions about black walnuts. I have a piece of property in Madison, and I am finding that I'm having a very hard time keeping turf healthy under and around a mixture of black walnut trees and hickory trees. I'm wondering if the issues with black walnuts can also poison out turf.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's my best guess is what you're seeing. So black walnut produces a chemical in its roots, jugulone, which is basically toxic to other plants, including many grasses. There are probably some things you can do, like bringing in compost or maybe a biochar, some type of organic amendment to the soil that would dilute the production of the herbicide. You can seed into that. That might be a continual practice that you need to do. So every spring and fall, maybe bring in some compost into the lawn so that the grass roots can avoid some of the exposure to that herbicide, but it's going to be a difficult challenge. But again, also underneath trees, hickory, walnut, there is shade and there is competition for water, and those things make growing grass difficult. So it might be that you look at other types of plants that are documented to be good for that situation, and I don't know any off the top of my head right now.
Barbie mailed to ask, what are the best grasses for sandy soils in central Wisconsin? Barb lives just north of the Dells, Wisconsin Dells.
Yeah, that's a common one. Sandy soils, you're going to want a hard fescue, sheep fescue, chewings fescue. That kind of the collection of fine fescues are the best options. And it can include the red fescues as well. So they still may have trouble because sandy soils, we don't get rain for a long time. The grass may not grow very well, but those fescues can tolerate those sandy soils better than any other grass we have.
Eric in Zarboy, is it?
Darboy. Darboy with a D.
Oh, Darboy. Okay.
Yeah.
Where's that located?
Thanks. It's right near, just south of Kimberly and
okay.
A little east of Appleton.
Okay, got it.
Okay, so I have a lot of moss growing in my backyard. I'm in kind of a wooded area, so it gets partial sun or half sun. And the moss just continues to take over, and it creates it so that the grass will actually not be able to root very well because it will actually, I'll take my foot and sometimes rub it right off the ground. The grass doesn't get any roots hardly.
Yeah, right. And you want to grow, you want a lawn.
Yeah.
I want a lawn, yeah.
Yeah, and what's the soil type like? Is it sandy?
No, it's not. It's underneath it's clay, but it's probably just pretty black dirt.
Okay. Okay, so what's happening here is probably that the shade is creating conditions where the grass isn't isn't able to compete. And then the moss comes in, it creates sort of like a crust or a barrier to prevent the grass from going in. So, you know, what I would do is renovate the lawn. It sounds like it's mostly moss and not a lot of grass anyway, so sort of till it up and then reseed. The best time to do it is going to be around September, and then go with a very shady, shade-tolerant mix. So you don't want Kentucky bluegrass or perennial ryegrass. You want mostly the fine fescues, which we've been talking an awful lot about this program. But Chewing's fine fescue, in that seeded, you know, fresh start, and then you want to maintain that to keep that density up. But my guess is the grass that was planted there is just, you know, a lot of Kentucky bluegrass. It's very bad choice for shade, and no matter what you do to it, it's not going to recover. So you want to start fresh with a Chewing's fescue that can handle that shade level.
All right, Eric, thank you very much for calling. Mark in Little Chute, your turn now. Hi, Mark.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
So last May, I was given weed killer, which turned out to be weed and grass killer, and I killed my whole lawn. And so middle of summer with a lot of watering, I got about 25% of my lawn to grow with a lot of seeding. I was wondering what I can do now to start my new lawn, or is there a residual killer still in there that's taking out my lawn?
Yeah, highly unlikely that what you applied would still be having negative effects now. So right about now or in the next couple weeks would be a good time to seed those thin or bare areas. You can use an overseeder, which will have little discs in it that will drop seed in the furrows that it makes. Those things are heavy and unwieldy, and I don't really like them. My choice is to use a power rake or a thatch rake, which will create similar slits into the lawn, and then you can sprinkle seed on top, rake it down, tamp it down, and the seed will kind of fall into those slits, and hopefully start to regrow. So Kentucky bluegrass is a good grass to seed because it will spread. And it, in most cases, except for dense shade, it survives a lot of Wisconsin's conditions.
Good luck, Mark. Thank you very much for calling. And Richard in Appleton, let's go to you. Hi, Richard.
Hi there. I am in the Appleton area, and I recently had a blue spruce cut down with the stump ground. And I'm wondering how best to prepare the soil for replanting of a grass seed.
Yeah, good question. So the stump's ground, there's good topsoil there. It should be relatively loose, or that you want to make it loose, so you can till it up and break it up by hand or with an implement. Then you seed. You choose your grass if it's regular. You know, there's full sun mixes that have, you know, mostly Kentucky bluegrass. There's part sun, part shade that usually has Kentucky bluegrass with some of the fine fescues. If there's a lot of trees there, you might want to go toward the fine fescue end. Seed that down into the soil that's loosened. Rake it in you know, bury it by about a quarter inch, and then you want to step on it, tamp it down so you get good seed-to-soil contact. Put down some mulch. I usually just use a straw mulch, but there's many different types of mulch you can buy. And then make sure you keep it wet. So watering it once or twice a day in the early spring, you should see that seed start to pop, and then pretty soon you'll have cover over that blue spruce tree.
Richard, by the way, how big an area did you have?
Oh, it's about 30 feet in diameter.
Oh, big area.
Yeah, so, I mean, but same principles will apply. Where the new seedlings fail, when they tend to fail, is inadequate soil preparation. So if the soil's hard and you put seed down, you're not going to get much take on that. You need to loosen the soil probably top 2 inches as an absolute minimum, and then put your seed down and then rake it in and get that good seed to soil contact. So, you know, you can do that. It's a lot of handwork, but there are rototillers and other machines, powered machines that can make go a little faster.
Yeah. Richard, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Mitchell emailed to ask if there's any way to mix in different flowers on the lawn without digging up the whole lawn. Can you overseed anything?
Yeah, we've had tremendous success overseeding white clover. It's a really aggressive growing plant. It won't totally outcompete the grasses. So what I don't have a ton of information on is some of the other flowers that people might want to plant. But I would say go ahead and try it yourself. The principles are all the same. Go through it one more time here. Cut your lawn down relatively low, so about as low as your mower can go. And then rent a power rake or a dethatcher that will create these slits, go in two directions, so you kind of create a diamond or a square pattern on your lawn, and then sprinkle the seed mixture, the flower mixtures on top of that, and then, you know, walk over it, roll over it, drive over it, try to get the seed to soil contact to be good, and then water it, and the water is there to provide good growing conditions for the flowers that you planted, and fingers crossed you get some of those flowering plants to survive. Like I said, I've done it a ton of times with clover, and we always have very good success when we follow those steps.
Lisa emailed. She has plantain taking over areas of her lawn. She tried to pull it without success. Wonders about a broadleaf herbicide. Her yard has lots of white clover and violets, so she's concerned about the herbicide killing those as well. And will fertilizing the yard also feed the plantain and the creeping Charlie?
Yeah, a lot there. So what we've learned, plantain is sometimes indicative of compacted soils, so you might be seeing it in higher traffic areas, but not always. A traditional broadleaf herbicide will control plantain fairly well. What I would suggest is using a spot-treated approach. So you said you tried pulling it, which tells me that it is something that you can kind of walk around to. So just, you can buy a handheld one, you can have a backpack one, but you can just spray the plantain plants themselves, which will avoid damage to the clover and the violets that you want to preserve. Yes, fertilizing the lawn will also feed the other maybe weeds that you don't want, but in general, the effect is positive for encouraging grass. So I wouldn't discourage you from feeding your lawn two or three times a year to encourage that density of the grass.
Scott in Eau Claire. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Doug, I have some yellow spots in my yard. I actually have three of them, and they're expanding every year. The grass is real stiff almost, and it's just when it rains, when we get steady rain, then the green grass will come up through it. But the minute it dries out, then this yellow comes through, and it's kind of a stiff. It kind of reminds me of the old seltzer you used to get in packing stuff years and years ago. But it's real a stiff, thick grass, and it's getting to the point, no matter what I do to it, I can't seem to get rid of it.
Interesting. It sounds like it is a different. It's a patch of grass that different species. It could be zoysia grass, which is a warm season grass that grows in patches.
That's what I was thinking.
And it's difficult to get rid of it. I guess you can use a non-selective herbicide like glyphosate, which is used, traditionally called Roundup, although we talked about the perils of that name. Other than, it could be Nimblewill, which is another warm season grass that grows in patches with stiff leaves. So it sounds like you have maybe a warm season grass that's invading. It could also be related to the soil that's there. But I guess the first step would be let's get a proper identification of it. You can find my email address online. You can send me pictures and I can see what I can do, or if we have to send in a sample to our turfgrass diagnostic lab, they can help with identification and come up with some solutions for you. But my guess is it's going to involve renovating those spots.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Scott, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Diana emailed to ask if you have suggestions for getting rid of violets in a lawn. Every year they spread more. Once she tried a weak solution of 2,4-D, but it didn't seem to impact them.
Yep. Violet control is difficult. They, like the quack grass we talked about in the beginning of the show, they have underground storage organs, tubers that can withstand a lot of stress, including herbicides. The triclopyr that we recommend for Creeping Charlie is also one of the more effective products on wild violet. And the other approach is that these, they're native to Wisconsin. They are provide some color, some diversity to the lawn. And so living with some population of them is also something to consider. But triclopyr applied in the spring, possibly the fall, will be probably your best chemical control for those wild violets.
We'll probably be talking more about violets coming up in our next segment, which is coming up in a couple of minutes, Herbs in Every Season. I know violets are discussed in the book, and we'll probably talk with the author a little bit about that. In the meantime, Doug, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Yeah, you bet, Larry. I always look forward to this.
And we'll look forward to your next visit. Doug Soldat, our guest today. Always great to have him come by. Professor and chair of the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison. His PhD is horticulture, and he specializes in turf grass, among other things. And coming up, we'll be talking about that new book. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along here for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to turn our attention to herbs. Herbs for culinary and medicinal purposes have been around for thousands of years. And up next, our expert will talk about how you can add them to your garden. And that guest is Bevan Cohen. He is an award-winning author, an herbalist, owner of Small House Farm in Michigan. He also hosts the Seeds and Weeds podcast and offers workshops and lectures across the country on the benefits of living closer to the land through seeds, herbs, and locally grown food. And his latest book, and it is a dandy, I like it a lot, it's Herbs in Every Season, 48 Edible and Medicinal Herbs for the Kitchen, Garden, and Apothecary. So as we talk with Bevan, I hope you'll join in. What are your favorite herbs? How do you use them? What questions do you have about growing herbs? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Great to have you join in. And Bevan Cohen, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, Larry, thanks so much for having me here today.
I really like your book. Let's start with something pretty basic. What's the traditional definition of an herb, and maybe versus your definition?
Oh, this is a great question. Now, botanically speaking, an herb is a plant with a fleshy green stem that dies back at the end of the season. So many of the plants that we might even consider to be herbs botanically don't fall into that category. So that would be things like, even rosemary or thyme, which any of us would consider an herb, botanically speaking, really isn't. So in the book, we do talk about a number of plants that I guess don't quite fit that definition, but for all of us, we'd consider them herbs. But we even talk about a few different trees and actually a couple mushrooms as well. There's so many wonderful plants out there. I didn't want to leave anybody out, Larry, so we kind of included a whole bunch of them.
And, before we go too far, you have a kind of a disclaimer at the front of your book. Talk about that a bit.
Well, the disclaimer at the book, there's a couple things that we wanted to talk about in the disclaimer. First off, when we're harvesting any sort of plants, we want to make sure that we're going to properly identify those, especially, if we're using them for food or medicine or anything like that. Every once in a while, some of these beneficial plants will have a doppelganger that maybe isn't quite as beneficial, So we wanted to make sure
that we're always making safe and healthy choices when we're out there harvesting plants.
That makes very, very good sense. And I liked how you organized it, your book. It's organized around the seasons, and I assume you had maybe more than one reason for doing that.
Well, you know, it was just kind of, first off, a fun way to organize the herbs, right? But I wanted to make it accessible to folks. You know, what we're going to find is that throughout the seasons, the plants that are available to us kind of change. We've got a few that have come out in the spring, and they're really showing off in the spring, you know, things like violets or dandelions or whatever. And then as we move through summer and into fall, those plants change. But also, Larry, we change, right? And our needs change as well throughout the year, or we could even say maybe the seasons of our lives, right? So it was just such a fascinating observation that as we change, the plants change with us. So we've always got something available to us. Mother Nature is always providing for all of our needs.
Ben in Madison has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Ben.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
So my question is this. I'm fascinated by the medicinal qualities of plants, and I've just been starting to play with hydroponics. And I'm wondering if there's seeds and variations that are more suitable to raise hydroponically.
This is a fantastic question. You know what? Many of our favorite culinary herbs, so we can say again, thyme and rosemary, basil, oregano, many of the mints, those are all plants that are going to do wonderful in a hydroponic situation. You know, what's cool about herbs is that, I mean, they're very easy to grow. They don't mind a little bit of abuse. They're going to do well in basically any soil, it seems like. So herbs are a great place for any gardener to get started, and they're wonderful in a hydroponic situation because herbs are just so adaptable.
Yeah, there you go, Ben. Thank you for calling. What do you think? Are fresh herbs the best?
Well, you know, it depends on what we're going to be doing with them. If we're looking to work with them medicinally or even simply to make like herbal tea, I actually recommend dried herbs. You know, the dried herbs are going to be a little bit more potent. Once we've, you know, dried the herbs, we're just essentially evaporating the water out of them, right? Which concentrates the volatile oils, the chemical constituents, the flavors are a little bit more concentrated. So you don't need as much plant material to make a nice cup of tea as you would if you were working with fresh. But we use fresh herbs quite often in the kitchen as well. So you'll find through the book that we utilize both depending on which situation is right. So we try to guide the reader into understanding what is your ultimate goal for this herb and what is the best way to work with it to achieve that goal.
How long should herbs be, or could they be successfully stored?
This is an awesome question. This is a question I get a lot. You know, the typical rule of thumb you'll often hear is that herbs well stored can keep for a year. But I often find that herbs can keep much longer than that. If we dry the herbs quickly, if we make sure that we dry and process the herbs efficiently and get them put away and store them in an airtight container in a cool, dark location, they can last much longer than that. So every year, though, we're going to want to take stock of our herb supply, open up those jars, look in there. If the herbs still have a very vibrant color, if they're still aromatic, if you can still identify what that plant is by its smell, it's still good enough to use, absolutely, even if more than a year has passed.
Yeah. What have we lost by being able to buy herbs and medicines without growing or gathering ingredients ourselves?
Well, I think we've lost a lot. We've lost our relationship with the world around us in a way. You know, when we're growing our own plants, whether it be for food or medicine, we have that opportunity to develop that relationship. We get to see that plant through its life cycle, you know, from seed to seed, and really get to know everything about it on a more personal level. I think that when we rely on plants that we're just going to be purchasing from the grocery store, we're losing out on a lot of diversity, too. You know, at the grocery store, there's a limited selection of things that are available to us. You know, there's going to be one type of basil available at the grocery. But in your garden, there's dozens of types of basil that you can grow, right? So by growing these things at home, it just opens the door to just a whole wide, wondrous world of diversity out there.
Let's talk about, I said at the beginning that I really enjoyed your book, and I did, and maybe you could describe for our listeners what people are going to find for each of the 48 plants you highlight.
So there are 48 plants, and that's going to be divided into the seasons. So we've got 12 herbs for each season. And for each one of the herbs, we really try to talk about a little bit of history and folklore about the plant, because I love to share that sort of thing. We're going to find growing information or gathering, if it's a wild plant, when and where to forage the plant, how it likes to be grown in the garden, whatever it might be. We're going to talk about a multitude of uses for the plant medicinally, how we can utilize it in the apothecary, how we can make it into health and beauty products. There's also a whole section on culinary applications for each one of the plants. So we're going to talk about all the different ways that we can use it in the kitchen. And then, Larry, there is a ton of recipes. There are so many recipes in this book for both the kitchen and the apothecary to really help people make use of these plants and use them in new ways and really just explore all of these different flavors and aromas and possibilities that the plants offer us. You know, I really try to use this book as an opportunity to share a snapshot of what life is like for us here at Small House Farm. And herbs are a part of our daily life. They're everything that we do. They're in our food. They're in our medicine. They're in our gardens. They're in our wild places, you know. So I really try to capture all of that and get into the book so people could experience that as well.
I tell you, I was looking at those recipes, and there are so many interesting ones. That goldenrod hollandaise sauce, or the, let's see, what was another one? Oh, there was a, bread. Chamomile bread, I think it was.
Yes, it was. Yeah, we did so many interesting things like that. So for the recipes, I tried to do some things that were, you know, basic ideas. So everybody, regardless of your experience cooking, you could try these recipes. But I really wanted to kind of push the envelope a little bit, like with this goldenrod hollandaise, or we do a super sunflower cornbread, or a shiitake and lemon balm stuffing. You know, these just kind of a little bit more off the wall ideas, ultimately to help people feel more confident exploring flavors in the kitchen, but also letting them see plants through a different perspective. That's really the goal here, is to help people see things from a different point of view and try new things and experiment and just appreciate all of these wonderful things and feel brave enough and confident enough to do it. So I really try to explore all sorts of different ways that we could work with these plants.
Yeah, you do indeed. And you talk about extractions in the book, a fair amount. What's that process?
Well, so, you know, it's a very simple process, really. And we could think of an extraction. One of the most common ones your listeners probably know, of course, is like a vanilla extract that we're going to use in the kitchen. That's simply an alcohol extraction. That's vanilla beans in alcohol. And the alcohol extracts, it works as a solvent to extract the alcohol-soluble chemicals from the plant material, from the vanilla bean. And we can do the same thing when we brew a cup of tea. We're using water as the solvent to extract water-soluble chemicals. Or we can utilize oil to extract the fat-soluble chemicals. We can utilize vinegars to extract the minerals from stuff. So essentially, we're just like brewing a cup of tea. You're adding the herbs to a container. You're adding your solvent to it. And then it just pulls out all that goodness, all the colors, all the flavors, all the nutritional value suspended in your solvent, thus making your tea, your tincture, whatever the extract might be.
You know, I was chuckling a little bit. And our first section, we were talking about lawns. And a couple of people called about violets. I think one person wanted to get rid of them, and the other person wanted to save them. And violets, by the way, are Wisconsin state flower, and we have a lot of them. And you talk about using violets in your book.
Oh, most certainly. I love the violet. I didn't know that it was a state flower. That's very cool. That it's such a beautiful little plant. So I would fall obviously into the second team there, the ones that are trying to save them. When we moved out here to Small House Farm, there were no violet on the property at all. And I actually dug some up from a friend's house and brought them and introduced them to my property just so I could have them to enjoy them.
it's and maybe if you can remember, talk about how you use them.
Oh, yeah, we use them in so many different ways. One of the fun ways, and I was just talking with somebody about this earlier, too, is we actually made a violet flower syrup. So we would infuse, essentially make a tea with the violet flowers and then make a simple syrup with sugar or honey. And so you have this nice, thick, sweet, beautiful purple syrup that you can make from it. And you could put this in your coffees. You could put this, drizzle it all over cakes or pancakes. I've made frosting with it, so you get like a beautiful purple, violet-flavored frosting. There's just so many cool ways that we can make use of these plants.
Oh, man, that sounds great. Christina in Glenwood City has something, I think, relating to teas. Christina?
Hi there. Thank you. I am wondering if you do anything with SAFT, which is ESSAICT, which contains burdock root, sheep sorrel, turkey rhubarb, and slippery elm bark.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah. I have not worked with that particular tea blend before, but it sounds like a very potent herbal combination, most certainly working with the burdock root, which is very nutritious and good for you, those different mushrooms that you've mentioned. That sounds like a very nourishing, supportive tea for your immune system, supporting and strengthening many of your body systems, as a matter of fact. But no, I haven't worked with that particular tea blend before.
Yeah. Christina, does that answer your question?
It does, and I agree with him. It is a very potent, nutritious, and healing form of tea. So I would encourage everybody to look into it. Thank you.
All right. Christina, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Talking today with Bevan Cohen, award-winning author, herbalist, and owner of Small House Farm in Michigan, and his latest book is Herbs in Every Season, 48 Edible and Medicinal Herbs for the Kitchens, the Garden, and Apothecary. Great to have him with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News and Garden Talk. Next week on the show, we'll be talking on Garden Talk with Sam Thayer about good and bad insects and how they relate to the garden. And so looking forward to that next week on Garden Talk. Right now, Bevan Cohen is talking with us about herbs, his book, Herbs in Every Season. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions and comments. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. You know, in the spring section, you had the calendula mentioned as a plant. And by the way, I wanted to also mention that you have some wonderful photography, so there's some really good photos of the plants. But calendula is kind of nice for the flowers, and you say a tangy flavor.
Oh, yeah. I love to grow calendula. You know, it's one of my favorite spring herbs, most certainly. We grow a big patch of it, for sure. We use it, obviously, in the apothecary. It's a nice emollient herb, so it's really good for softening and soothing the skin. So we'll make it into lotions and balms. But it does have a very tangy flavor. Now, in particular, the flower petals here, the leaves can be a little bit more bitter, although they are edible. You know, I would cook them first before I'd eat them. But the petals, you can use them in all sorts of ways. We actually, in the book, we do calendula petal butter sauce. That is absolutely fantastic. That I really enjoyed, for sure. But, we do grow a lot of calendula here, both for its flowers and for its seed. We have a small online seed company, and that's one of our most popular flower seeds that we offer is the calendula. I can never seem to grow enough of it, which I don't mind. It's such a colorful and beautiful plant that I like to tuck it into almost every garden bed.
Yeah. And while we're at it, why don't you mention your online presence?
Oh, yeah. So you can find us at smallhousefarm.com. And obviously you can find copies of the books there and that sort of thing. You can find our little seed shops. You can buy, we have herbs and flowers and veggies and that sort of stuff. All of the seeds that we offer, we grow and process right here on the farm. And then a whole apothecary, all of our herbal products that we offer are also available right there at smallhousefarm.com.
All right. This time of the year, another of the plants you mentioned was chickweed, which I found interesting. Provide some early flowers for bees, among other things.
That's right, among many other things, actually. I love to eat it myself. I find it to be quite delicious. We have a big patch of chickweed that grows sort of near the compost area. It's quite abundant. It almost grows like a carpet. And I'll gather it right up, and we can bring it in. When it's young and tender, you can eat it almost sort of like you might eat like sprouts or something. I put it on sandwiches. We add it to salads. It's very delicious. But it can also be gathered up, and we'll infuse it in oil and turn it into balms. It's great for itchy, red, rashy skin conditions. So we'll make it into salves and balms. I love to make a lip balm with chickweed. It's just such a wonderful plant, and it does come out early, and it's got those beautiful little tiny little flowers on it, and all the little pollinators are buzzing about, so they seem to enjoy it just as much as I do.
And I was thinking about dandelions too. There's rare is the lawn that does not have dandelions in it at some time. How do you use dandelions?
We can utilize the dandelion from the top of the flower to the bottom of the root. The whole thing is wonderful. So, of course, we can gather up the flowers. I'll take dandelion buds before they even open, before the flower opens, and we'll pickle them and use them just like capers. They're very nice. Once the blooms have come on, you can use them in a salad if you want, or we can infuse them into oils to make topical salves. They're mildly analgesic, so that means they offer pain relief. So they're great. We can make a massage oil with them for sore muscles. The leaves are beautiful, delicious, bitter greens. We've been gathering dandelion leaves actually right now, gathering them up. I like to saute them with a little garlic, a little olive oil or something. Absolutely delicious. Or you can have them fresh in salads. And we can even gather up the root. You can use the root for so many things. Of course, it's medicinal. But I also like to – I'll chop the root up, roast it in the oven so it gets a nice kind of like smoky flavor to it, and I'll use it. Now, some people would say a coffee substitute, Larry, but I don't believe there's really a substitute for coffee. So we'll say just like a coffee alternative. It makes a nice dark brew that you can enjoy. It's very rich and flavorful.
Matthew in Iron River, Michigan. We'll go to you now. Hi, Matthew.
Hello. Thanks for sharing your experience in this subject. What I was wondering is if you had ever experimented with using distillation for making the extractions from different plants, such as dandelions. I was kind of thinking about trying lavender, and I was just wondering if you ever tried that.
You know what, Matthew? This is an awesome question. So I have not personally utilized distillation to make stuff, but I have some associates. I've worked with some folks that do. They have some beautiful copper stills, and they are going to distill some incredible essential oils. What's really neat about distilling essential oils, and lavender would be such a fantastic choice for it, it's so wonderful, so aromatic, is that you can distill the essential oil, and then the other product that is created is the hydrosol. And the hydrosol is also very useful. It can be used as a topical wash. Some folks even can make delicious beverages with it. You know what I mean? So there's many cool products that you can make through the process of distillation. So I highly recommend you explore that idea and look into it. And you'll find there are so many great plants out there that you can work with. Lavender, of course, being one of them. Spruce tips. That's one of my favorites, a spruce tip essential oil. Oh, wow. So nice. So absolutely, Matthew, you should check that out.
Matthew, thanks for calling. And you can still join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. You know, another one of the spring plants that you mentioned was dill. And, you know, we kind of all have, you know, there's one way to look at dill, but you have other ways to look at dill other than just in pickling.
Well, let's not forget how great pickles are, you know what I mean? We should do a lot of dill for pickles. I mean, we pickle so many things, not just the cucumbers, but I like to pickle eggplants and baby zucchinis. I'll use the dill sometimes when I'm pickling my dandelion buds if we want to get that dill flavor. But dill is also a fantastic herb for a number of other things as well. So if we move that dill into the apothecary, we could think about utilizing the dill as an astringent wash, which is really nice for oily skin, for acne conditions, that sort of thing. It's great in tea for stomach upset, digestive complaints. So there's lots of cool ways that we can use the dill. And not just the leaf or the fronds of the plant, but the dill seed is also wonderful. I've even used the dill flower. It makes a very vibrantly flavored tea. But all parts of that plant are useful and totally awesome.
And what about parsley? Parsley, lots of us grow parsley. What about ways that we use parsley?
You know, it's always sad for me to see parsley just sort of get regulated as like a little garnish on the side of the plate, you know? This plant has so much potential. We can use it for so many things. The most important thing to note about parsley, I think, I'll say two things about it. One is how nutritious parsley is. It is loaded with vitamins and minerals, and that's kind of what gives it that flavor. You can almost taste the minerals in it. It's very, very strong, the flavor, and that's just the minerals coming through. And when we want to utilize the minerals in an herb, one of the best ways to extract that is utilizing vinegar. The acid in the vinegar will help pull those minerals out of that plant material. So we can make some really delicious salad dressings and marinades, just steeping the parsley, the leaf, or again, the seed is useful here, into these vinegars just to make some fantastic. I love it as a marinade for like chicken and fish and that sort of thing. So good.
Yeah, it's sounds pretty darn good to me. You make everything sound really good, Bevan, and yeah, not only in your speaking but in your writing as well. I want to try everything in the book. You know, you had some interesting. You had at the end of the book, and we can go back to other things as well. But you said there's a difference between the herb and the herbalist. We move together in tandem on our journey through life. It's not that we're working with nature. We are nature. We're learning to work more closely with ourselves. And you talked kind of a little bit at the beginning of the book, but maybe just expand on that for a touch.
Well, I think this is an interesting point. I'm glad that you brought this up. You know, working on this book has been many seasons in the making, and to really explore these ideas. Now, of course, this concept of relationship with the natural world is a big part of everything that I teach. Whenever I'm trying to teach people about whether it's herbalism or gardening, seed saving, whatever it might be, is this concept of relationship with the world around us, right? And fostering and nurturing that relationship. But working on this book and observing myself and the plants through the seasons and seeing that we were really one and the same. I find that we do ourselves a disservice if we think of ourselves as separate from nature, as we are cultivating the earth or whatever it might be, because we are nature, right? So I think that ultimately maybe this could be the thread throughout the book that I'm the tapestry that I'm trying to weave is this idea that we are the world around us, and that when we treat the world around us with respect, we benefit from that because we are that world, right? If we think about ourselves as separate, then maybe we're not going to be as responsible with our choices. Maybe we're not going to conserve the wild resources the way that we possibly should, right? But when we realize that nature and the gardener are one and the same, and it's a mutually beneficial relationship that we have, we might make different decisions out there. We might make more responsible decisions. And in the world that we're in right now, it seems like we really need to start making some very responsible decisions about the natural world around us.
Yeah, it was all good points. And I wanted to get your thoughts in on that before we get to the end of the show. One more question I think we might have time to answer. Devin, have you in the book, DIY ailments for things like mosquito bites and sunburn, those things are found in the book.
Oh, yeah, most certainly. And you'll find that we're going to experience those ailments in the summertime. And as many of the summer herbs that approach us, they're going to be perfect for that. You know, if we think about like another common weed that everybody experiences in their gardens, plantain. Plantain is a wonderful herb for helping us soothe the itching and swelling associated with insect bites. So right as we're experiencing that ailment, nature is providing us with the cure, right? So there are some very practical things. You know, we really pushed the boundary and tried to experiment with fun recipes and off-the-wall types of way of thinking, but there's a lot of it that's very much grounded in reality. These are day-to-day issues that we're going to face, and the herbs are right there to provide us, you know, for solutions to those as well.
And again, what's your website?
Smallhousefarm.com.
And you can find pretty much everything at there. I've been on the site. It's a great site. And Bevan, I want to thank you so much for taking some time to be with us today. I like your book a lot, and it was great talking with you. Thank you.
I appreciate it, Larry. Thank you so much.
Bevan Cohen, award-winning author, herbalist, owner of Small House Farm in Michigan. And the book we've been talking about is titled Herbs in Every Season. Subtitle, 48 Edible and Medicinal Herbs for the Kitchen, Garden, and Apothecary. I have trouble with that word sometimes. Great to have you listening in as well today on the show. It's always a pleasure for me to broadcast with you and talk with you, and our team members feel the same way. Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod are producers for the show. Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins are the technical directors, and our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening to Garden Talk, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.